Okay, hello everybody and welcome to this debate on Brexit. My name's Sue Cameron. I'm a journalist and broadcaster. I've been a columnist on the FT and on the Telegraph. I've presented Newsnight and Channel 4 News and Radio 4's Week in Westminster, concentrating usually on government. Now, this debate, as you know, is about the impact on government and Parliament of Brexit. Brexit's been described as the biggest political, administrative and legislative challenge since World War II. Some people might say that's rather a poor analogy, because in World War II, all the political parties, all the civil servants and the public were united in a common purpose of defeating the Nazis. But there's no such unity on Brexit. There have been clashes between government and Parliament. Both the main political parties are split over Brexit. Both of them have leaders that they don't really like. The Prime Minister is under constant threat from the so-called Brexiteers on her own side, who keep wanting to replace her, though nobody's quite sure who the replacement would be. And then there's Whitehall. Civil servants, the clue's in the name, do what their political masters tell them. But the politicians have been far too busy squabbling among themselves to give clear directions, though some of them have found time to accuse officials of being partisan. As for the public, who voted 52-48 in favour of Brexit, I think one recent poll showed that 71% of them think Brexit is going badly. And in a democracy, the voters are always right. So what are the long-term implications of all this for Parliament and for government? Well, we have a very good panel today. Vernon Bogdanore is Professor of Government at King's College London. His latest book, Brexit, The Constitution and the Future of the UK, will be published next year. He's been asking whether the sovereignty of the people will come to trump the sovereignty of Parliament. And I think I'm right in saying he suggested that only the people can resolve the Brexit dilemma through another vote. Joe Owen is Associate Director of the Brexit Programme at the Institute for Government think tank. One of the things he's been specialising in is how Whitehall is coping with Brexit. They're not a happy band of Humphreys. Robert Armstrong, the former Cabinet Secretary, who's been in, first went into Whitehall, I think, in the 1950s, he told me he'd never known such a, his words, not mine, shambles politically. And he and other senior Whitehall figures have strongly criticised Brexiteers for attacking civil servants instead of their political masters. As Robert Armstrong put it in a letter to The Times, people have been attacking Ollie Robbins, who's the Prime Minister's chief advisor on Brexit, and he said they should be criticising the organ grinder, not the organ grinder's monkey, if Mr. Robbins will forgive me for so describing him. Tony Travis is Professor at the School of Public Policy here at LSE. He's an expert on London and on the wider aspects of how the UK voted on Brexit and why and what the implications are for public policy making and for public trust in the governing class. Ladies and gentlemen, your panel. Now, each of our panellists is going to speak for 5 minutes or so, and we will have a little discussion among ourselves on some of the points raised, and then I will throw it open to the floor. Vernon, would you like to go first?
Thank you very much. Well, it's good of you to ask me to talk about Brexit. I think someone said that everything that could be said about Brexit had been said, but it hasn't yet been said by everybody. And what I want to talk about are the constitutional effects of Brexit. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the political effects. Indeed, I think it could be said that every Conservative Prime Minister since Harold Macmillan, except for Alec Douglas-Hume, who was only there for a year, has been destroyed by Europe. For Harold Macmillan, they would be Margaret Thatcher, John Major, David Cameron, and of course, possibly in the future, Theresa May, though I think when Theresa May's in trouble, she could remember the wise words of Ian MacLeod, who was colonial secretary in the early 1960s, who said the Conservative Party is a very generous party. It always forgives those who are wrong. Sometimes it even forgives those who are right. But there are massive constitutional consequences, I think, of Europe. And indeed, a colleague of mine at King's, Takis Tridimas, a professor of European law, said he thought the 2016 referendum was the most important constitutional event in Britain since the restoration of 1660. And it was for this reason that for the first time in our history, Parliament is being required to do something, or feels itself required to do something, that it does not wish to do. Because a majority of the cabinet, both now and in 2016, are Remainers. The majority of MPs, a larger majority now than in 2016, are for Remain. And a very large majority of the House of Lords are also Remainers. Now, Brexit is therefore coming about not because government or Parliament want it, but because we or you, the people, want it. And this is something quite without precedent in our long constitutional history. The referendum has become, on the European issue, in effect a third chamber of Parliament issuing legislative instructions to the other two. And in the conflict between a supposedly sovereign Parliament and a sovereign people, the sovereign people have triumphed. And therefore, Europe has been responsible for the introduction of a new principle into the British Constitution, the principle of the sovereignty of the people. Now, a lot of people object to that, and indeed, when we had our first referendum in 1975 on Europe, Monsieur Jean Rey, who'd been a vice president of the European, president of the European Commission, he opposed it, saying a referendum on this matter consists of consulting people who don't know the problems instead of consulting people who know them. I would deplore a situation, he said, in which the policy of this great country should be left to housewives. It should be decided instead by trained and informed people. But that argument goes a bit too far, because if the people aren't qualified to pronounce on a single issue, such as Britain's membership of the European Union, how can they be qualified to pronounce on the whole complex of issues which you face in a general election? And that argument, I think, bears some resemblance to that used by those who opposed the extension of the franchise before the Great Reform Act of 1832. But the reason that the referendum has been used on Europe, I think, has been twofold. Firstly, because it seems the party system does not work effectively on the European issue, because all the main parties are divided. And in 2015, if you were against Europe, the only way you could show that by your vote was a vote for UKIP, which would be very unlikely to form a government under our system. Indeed, it got 1/8 of the vote, but only one seat in Parliament. So really, the party system wasn't working very well. But secondly, even if it had been working well, there are some decisions on which this is won, on which Parliament is not competent, it's thought, to pronounce some fundamental matters. And they involve the transfer of the powers of Parliament either upwards to Europe or downwards through legislative devolution, which is why we have referendums on those issues, because we appoint MPs to be our agents for us to legislate, but not to transfer the powers away from us that we give them in general elections. They come back to us after 5 years with those powers still intact. Still, the principle of the sovereignty of the people is very dangerous, and I imagine there are some people in the audience who rather regret the result in 2016, and who might therefore come to sympathise with the view of the great French reactionary Joseph de Maistre, who was opposed to the French Revolution, and said the principle of the sovereignty of the people is so dangerous that even if it were true, it would be necessary to conceal it. So that is the first implication of Europe. The sovereignty of the people has triumphed for the first time in British history over the sovereignty of Parliament. The second is we're doing something else completely unique in our constitutional history, I think in world constitutional history. We're all familiar, I think, with the process of entrenchment in constitutions and how things are protected against majorities, for example, in the American Constitution. We are going through the opposite process, a process of disentrenchment, a process of moving from a protected constitutional system, which was the European Union, based on the treaty, which is in effect a constitution, dividing powers between the Commission, the Council, the Parliament and the Court, to an unprotected constitution based, in theory at least, upon the sovereignty of Parliament. And the protections which the European Union gave us were much strengthened by the Lisbon Treaty of 2008, which legislated the European Union's Charter of Fundamental Rights into the system. Now, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with the European Convention of the Human Rights Act, and you will know that the Human Rights Act does not allow judges to strike down legislation contravening human rights. All the judges can do is issue a declaration of incompatibility, which has no legal effect. It's a statement. It's then up to Parliament to decide whether to put things right or not by a special fast-track procedure. And so far it has done so in every case, except for prisoners' voting rights. The European Court of Human Rights said that the blanket ban is unconstitutional, and the government's promised it will put that right. It hasn't yet done so. But there's clearly the potential for a conflict there between the principle of parliamentary sovereignty and the principle of human rights. And I once asked a very senior judge what would happen if there was a conflict between those principles, if Parliament passed an act against human rights, the courts issued a declaration and Parliament did nothing. And the senior judge smiled at me and said, well, that's a question that ought not to be asked, in a very British way. But the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights improves on the Convention in two ways. First, it has a much wider collection of rights, the 54 articles in it, than we had in the Convention in 1951. And clearly, if you were drawing up the Convention today, you would draw it more widely. For example, the Convention has a right to education, but not a right to health care. And perhaps the most important right in the European Charter is a right to equality on a huge number of grounds, including specific protection for the LGBT community, but also on other grounds of race and gender and political opinion and so on and so on. And the second way in which it's an improvement on the European Convention is that because it's part of European Union law, it's allowed judges to strike down legislation that went against it. And this was done for the first time in 2017 in the Benkhar-Bush case, which I think is at least as important as Factotane, when the judges found for Ms. Benkhar-Bush, who was employed by the Sudanese embassy, and wasn't paid the minimum wage and didn't get certain other rights, and the Sudanese embassy said they were protected by the State Immunity Act of 1978, the British Parliament. And the court said, well, you're not protected by that because the European Convention says that you must have a remedy against this sort of thing. The European Convention doesn't give you that remedy because you can't strike down legislation, but the European Charter does, and therefore we're going to strike down the relevant part of the State Immunity Act as contrary to European Union law. It's the first time this happened in British history. There were two other occasions on which this charter has been used. I'm just coming to a conclusion. One of them, ironically, by David Davis, the Brexit Secretary, who said that the Data Protection Act did not actually protect data, and he brought a case saying that it went against European Union principles, rather ironically. Now, my conclusion is this. The charter is not being incorporated into British law. All the rest of European Union law is, but not the charter. So we are again unprotected. We're the only country with New Zealand and to some extent Israel with an unprotected constitution. Every other democracy has a codified constitution. So I conclude by asking the question, is Brexit going to be our constitutional moment in which we realise we cannot continue any more than unprotected constitutions? Thank you.
very much indeed. Joe, can I come to you next? Whitehall, I think, has 300 separate Brexit work streams, projects across 20 different departments. They're finding they've found it very difficult to get any direction out of the politicians. So how are they coping?
So there's a pretty short answer to the how ready is Whitehall, but it's probably not the one you think. The question is ready for what, right? I mean, we are 2 years in and we don't know what's going to change, we don't know how much it's going to change, and we don't know when it's going to change, which are kind of three quite important things if you're trying to get ready for something. But if you kind of if you step beneath that, so what are the tasks that are happening inside government? Well, there's kind of three big tasks under the Brexit banner. There is negotiations, so agreeing our withdrawal by the time we leave the institutions in March next year, and then agreeing a future relationship after that. On legislation, there is preparing the UK statute book for life outside the EU, and kind of giving legislative effect to whatever we agree with the EU. And then there's the implementation task, which is putting the systems and processes and things in place that we need for life outside the EU. So I'm going to talk about negotiation implementation, which is partly because I thought Dominic Grievous here, and I didn't want to embarrass myself talking about legislation.
Yes, I should have said, I'm sorry, Dominic Grievous, as you can see, is not with us. I'm afraid he had to go and vote, so I beg your pardon for not saying that.
No, we can get into legislation in the questions, maybe. So on the negotiation, where are we? I think, actually, in many ways, we're in a pretty predictable place. If you park to one side some of the sort of heroic statements of easiest trade deal in the world, you know, it's going to be an absolute breeze. If you put that to one side, we are at the back end of a very political, very complicated negotiation with the EU. We've got 95% of it agreed. The last bit is the hardest bit that we still haven't nailed down yet, and both sides are using the time frame to ratchet up the pressure. And if you spoke to any kind of most EU diplomats or diplomats that work with the EU, they will say that sounds pretty much like par for the course when you are working with the EU. So that doesn't mean to say, you know, we are in that predictable position, but it doesn't mean to say it's been a breeze. I mean, it certainly hasn't been a breeze. But often people say the kind of UK walked into this negotiation with no idea what it's doing. It didn't know how to negotiate with the EU. It was a kind of rabbit in the headlights. But that's also not true, right? Because we have been negotiating with the EU for the last 40 years. You know, lots of officials will tell you that being a member of the EU is just one long negotiation, whether it's about new financial services regulations, or it is about annual fishing quotas, or a rebate to the budget. They are constantly negotiating. But it is true that this negotiation feels very, very different to that, right? So the way that the UK has been successful in the past in Europe is by having corridor conversations in Brussels and working in the fringes of meetings and pulling together coalitions of similarly minded countries. And now we are sat 6 foot away from the European Commission in a formal negotiating room with fixed timelines, fixed agendas, and no opportunity to kind of manoeuvre in the way that we used to. And that has made it, I think, you know, if you speak to senior negotiators, they will tell you that's been a real challenge. It's been something that we've really had to get used to in Brussels. And the kind of bad news is it's probably only going to get worse, right? When we leave the institutions in March next year, the negotiation becomes much bigger, covering a much broader area. When we start talking about things like trade, like security, there are much more... there's much more divided interests, both in the UK and the EU. At the moment, we've been looking at citizens' rights, transition, money, and then obviously the very contentious issue of the Irish border. But it's going to turn into an even more of a challenge, right, once we get through. So I guess to sum up on the negotiations point, I'd say there was probably three lessons that you could learn from the last phase of talks. The first one being... we need to speed up. So often the UK makes its decisions about policy proposals and what it wants to do basically using the big sound of the ticking clock to drive the focus in the cabinet to break through a consensus. And if you do that, what you do is you forego the opportunity to influence in Europe in the months leading up to said critical decision being made. The way it was put to me is we've spent, you know, the first quarter of this year, we spent arguing amongst ourselves about what we wanted in government when we should have been out there in European capitals making sure that what we wanted was on the table when we finally started talking about it. The second lesson I will pull out is around the UK being too reactive. And by this I mean it is always the EU that puts forward draft legal texts. The UK has preferred, with the notable exception of the Chequers White Paper, is preferred to make its policy announcements through speeches. So this allows the Prime Minister to draft around some of the thorny issues. You can start use rhetoric or colourful language to hide some of the issues in Cabinet and keep everyone on side. But that what that means is when you get into the room and you're sat opposite the EU, it's their draft text that you're working off, and they've kind of set the playing field. And then the final point I'd make, reflections on the negotiations, is having an idea what there is a majority for. We are at the stage now in the Brexit process where the most likely cause, it's probably fair to say, of no deal is the UK Parliament not being able to agree and not being able to crystallise a majority for anything. Most other countries doing international trade agreements will do a lot of that work as much as they can up front, trying to agree a formal mandate that says, this is what we are going to negotiate, these are the bounds of what we're going to negotiate, and it allows you to get some of those difficult conversations out the way first. Now, that's not to say that with the current political situation and the lack of majority, it's not going to still be a challenge, but I think there needs to be more effort going in up front. Then the next point I want to make, as I said, is about implementation. And as you said too, at the moment pretty much every department is working on Brexit, and they have at least three different scenarios they're working to. So no deal next year, no deal in December 2020, so we agree a transition but we can't agree a future relationship, and then there is some kind of future relationship that covers a whole sort of multitude of sins. And if you took any one of those scenarios, it would be pretty heroic and unprecedented for the government to deliver it, even if you knew exactly what you were delivering and the exact time frame. So, to put it in context, no deal next year will have been will be less than 3 months from when votes dropped into the ballot box in June 2016. Automatic pension enrolment took government 12 years. Universal credit, it's about 10 years. One of the other examples that's used quite often is the Olympics, right? And we spoke to a very senior official who had kind of run out of patience for the Olympic analogy. We kind of said that actually the Olympic, it's kind of more comparable to delivering the Olympics if you don't know what year it's going to be in, which city it's going to be in, or whether it's the Summer or Winter Games. So it's a huge amount of uncertainty. So how has Whitehall coped for this? How has it kind of realigned? Well, there are... there's obviously the Department for Exiting the European Union that sits in the centre, coordinating, acting the kind of quarterback and making sure that the departments are driving in the right direction. You have the new Department for International Trade that is looking for what Global Britain really means. And then you have literally thousands and thousands of new civil servants all across Whitehall. I think there have been 7,000 to date, roughly, new entrants to the civil service, possibly a further 9,000 predicted coming down the track. And what that means for, take the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, they between 2010 and 2016, they lost one in three staff through driving headcount reduction. In some cases, pretty painful trying to drive out savings. In 18 months after the referendum, that was fully reversed, and it is looking to go kind of double that again over the next year or so, I think is the latest numbers they've said. So the shape and size of Whitehall is changing pretty dramatically to cope with this challenge. Now, the last point I want to make is something that you touched on, Sue, is the kind of the interplay between politics and the kind of planning and the sort of toxic interplay with the politics and the practicalities of actually delivering Brexit. And we are at a position where, you know, we did a piece of work earlier in the year where, you know, we heard that because of divisions in the cabinet, departments were finding it very difficult to share information with one another. And when you have 30 departments or 26 departments and agencies responsible for ensuring you're ready at the border, if they can't work together, that's a real challenge. It's also the case that government has been very sheepish about speaking publicly about its plans and the practicality plans for Brexit, you know, including no deal. We've started to get a bit of that in the last few weeks, but government has struggled to properly engage the hundreds of thousands of businesses who will also have to make a change when we leave the EU. And that is because the politics says we can't go out to them yet. We want to put forward this, to coin a phrase, strong and stable positioning. And if we start warning about some of these consequences, it's not going to look good. And so one of the kind of, I guess one of the best ways of encapsulating that is the thing that Whitehall really needs is more time and certainty. And that is one of the things that the politics just cannot allow it at the moment. The best example being last week, and I'll close on this as a kind of quite nice example, is last week the EU said we could offer you an extension to the transition. And so if you're the UK government, I would be very surprised if Theresa May has received any kind of formal advice that says you can conclude within 21 months a trade agreement with the EU that's faster than any of the trade agreements the EU has negotiated recently, and is probably significantly more ambitious. And as well as doing that, you can then implement that agreement by December 2020. So 21 months to agree and implement. It's very unlikely she had advice that that's going to be doable, and if anything, we're going to need more time. But rather than saying, yes, okay, we'll take the option of a transition, the politics has said, no, you can't get through Parliament. So I can probably make, I'm not a gambling man, but if I were, I would make a prediction that in 12 or 18 months, we will probably be in a pretty painful and pretty expensive negotiation with the EU about getting that extra time if we say no to it now.
Thank you very much indeed. Tony, how far has Brexit, often described as toxic, which seems fair enough, how far has that further eroded public trust in government, and how, according to some of the work you've done, has the country divided over it? I mean, Vernon was saying it hasn't divided on normal right-left lines. Mm. Are there any other ways in which you can assess the way the country's divided?
Well, I mean, we do have extant polling evidence that now shows us that public, whether they voted leave or remain, isn't massively optimistic about the way things are going. In fact, rather the opposite, and that opinion has shifted. Although actually, as we know, that the opinion on leave and remain themselves hasn't shifted that much. But in terms of optimism about the likely effects, that has become substantially more pessimistic over time. But on the broader question about trust in politics, what intrigues me about all of this is the fact that, cheap point, but bear with me, when people voted for Brexit, and a very large number of them did, a significant number of them will have voted to leave the EU, but many of them voted for other things entirely. And what intrigues me about, you know, what we just heard from both Vernon and Joe, is that the time available and the scope available for Whitehall, which is a formidable machine, to do things other than the one big thing it's now doing, is absolutely minimal. Mm. So the machine is engulfed. If I can compliment both the other speakers, they've both done great work on the Constitution, in Vernon's case, the IFG, in terms of just monitoring all of this. You know, my favourite chart, which I've scissored and pasted into several presentations, is one that shows, you know, big fall in the number of people in the civil service from 2010 all the way down to 2016, and it's just gone off the bottom like, you know, a hockey stick, and it will go up. So it's a remarkable, but despite the expansion of the civil service, most people working in it are now working on only one thing. And by the way, notwithstanding the qualities of the civil service, the fact that the ministers, I mean, how much time do you think ministers have to talk about, oh, I don't say housing policy, important issue for the UK, particularly in the south of England, but the truth is they're spending an inordinate amount of their time buried in the machinations of you know, what to do about this little corner of Brexit strategy, or how to deal with that rebellion, or whatever it is next. So, I just want to pick out three in the on the trust front, three issues. We assume that many people who voted for Brexit, perhaps all of them, wanted to leave the EU, but many of them also, we believe, voted separately about other issues about which they felt aggravated. Perfectly legitimate thing, it's a democracy, you can use any vote for whatever purposes you need. And I would choose three. One of them was immigration. The other, we know lots of polling about that. The other was, I think, some of them voted for higher public expenditure, in the sense they were offered higher public expenditure from the money that was going to be saved, and this point's been made subsequently by politicians, not only those who supported Brexit. And the third one, which I think is by far the most important, is that this was a vote in part about decades of economic change in the United Kingdom and the failure of the United Kingdom government over that whole time to come up with a solution to the problem of how what happens to people who used to work in manufacturing, soon it will be other industries, by the way, because this is all about to happen again, and not being given the benefits of the globalised competitive economy that many people, particularly in big cities, have been able to. So I just take those three issues one by one. On immigration, I suspect what people expect to happen is that there will be a sharp reduction in immigration. That's what I suspect people wanted. But we know that two things. One is that, although and it's just nothing to do with the EU vote, actually, this, the government is still committed, to reducing migration to the tens of thousands. Even non-EU migration is running at about 150,000 a year. And actually, it has gone up one for one by the fall in the EU migration since the vote, which is now rising. So the two figures have swapped. One's now going up faster. So what I think this requires is either an acceptance and an argument by politicians that there is a necessary level of immigration which has to be defended, or, separately, a much more thought-through policy about how the UK economy could react to and effectively respond economically successfully with immigration that is in the tens of thousands. Neither of these things has happened. We've had neither debate since the vote. It's just carried on with, we've had a white paper, or actually a consultative document, I'm not sure it was a white paper, but no detailed policy for immigration. That's the first thing. The second issue, higher public expenditure, I'm not sure it was an element tangled up. I mean, and clearly the 2017 general election flushed this out in much more detail, that there is a sense that austerity, which has gone on since 2010, has reached some kind of a tipping point, and that the EU referendum probably picked this up as well. But the difficulty for the government here is that a lot of people who are strongly in favour of Brexit actually want to cut taxes as a response to global Britain, to making Britain more competitive. They have a vision of a very different kind of economy, which doesn't include a significant increase in public expenditure. And that dilemma has not been addressed at all by anybody at the top of politics. It's true, the Prime Minister, and how, you know, Joe's absolutely right about the use of words. I'm fascinated by the use of words to get over heart. You know, hinted that we might soon be able to come towards the end of austerity. I think that's broadly what she was saying. But the truth is that there is a longer-term difficulty for the government, which is having a zero deficit, having falling national debt, and having taxes that don't go up for most people does not allow austerity to come to an end. Now, that's an explicable thing to happen. We can have a particular kind of economy with a smaller state than France or Sweden or, frankly, many other European countries, but it does need to be explained. None of this hasn't been explained either. And last but not least, by far, in my view, the most important, is people who felt that years of economic change in the United Kingdom hadn't worked for them. Vernon was speaking to a group of my students earlier and made this point about a story about from the northeast during the referendum about how people would be poorer, better, less well off if they voted for Brexit. And somebody, misquoting this Brexit, somebody said, "Well, you know, what does that mean to us in effect? You know, we're not going to be poorer. You may be. You know, we haven't done so well out of recent economic change. So what might government have done about that? Well, in two obvious things. First, a massive reinvestment in further education and skills training, with an enormous concentration on that bit of the education system that gets very little coverage. Schools get lots of coverage, universities get lots of coverage, but FE and skills don't. That bit, and that, by the way, there's been huge cuts to that in the last 8 years, that part of the education system. And secondly, an economic policy. There are parts of the United Kingdom which haven't benefited from years and years and years of economic success, which have worked better for not just London and the South, but actually many of the key cities, university cities, have done perfectly well. But lots of other parts of the country haven't felt that this has worked for them. Now again, it's not easy, but if I can put this as simply as I can, I think if public policy had a single objective to help people, or to not just to help people, to allow people to feel that they had a share in the society so they didn't feel the need to respond in the way that some of them may have done, how do you help people in parts of the country or who themselves have been left behind by all this economic change compete with the rapidly trained, highly trained, and rapidly growing labour forces in India and China and Latin America? That's an objective the UK government could have set for itself. But again, since the referendum, I'm afraid little activity in this area, but nowhere near the amount that you would have thought would be triggered by a vote with the importance of the EU referendum. So, just to conclude, clearly the Brexit vote was in part about leaving the European Union, but it was almost certainly about other things besides. And my concern is this: until and unless a government finds a way of tackling what are these, all these other underlying issues, there is a risk that however Brexit turns out, the public will feel they haven't got what they voted for. And then the question is, what do they do next with their votes? Thank you.
Well, that was a really intriguing question to end on. Well, our speakers have covered an enormous amount of ground, heard about the constitutional implications, and whether the sovereignty of the people is going to trump the sovereignty of Parliament. We've heard from Joe about how Whitehall is desperate for time, a wonderful example of the Olympics, not knowing when it is, whether it's Winter or Summer Games and which cities it's going to be in. And Tony talking about how Brexit has squeezed out all these other areas that people, many people, desperately want something done about, and which they perhaps voted for Brexit in the hope that that's what it would do, a sort of a poke in the eye for governments that have failed to help them. Now, I want to, time is going on a bit, so I'd like to throw it open to the floor. Can you just put your hands up, and if you could say your name, and then I might try and take questions in threes. And I won't put everything to all the panel. Right, lady over there at the back.
Yes, hi. And my name is Sandra Kadoria. I'm supporting People's Vote at the moment, but used to work for government. A question for Vernon about legitimacy of the government. Do you see a point where this government is no longer representing the national interest, will begin to lose its legitimacy, and how will this sort of manifest? And for Tony, you talk about the economic change and inequality. Do you think this is behind the whole identity problem and the take back control? Do you think it's the economic forces that are behind that? Or was there something else about identity and take back control that you didn't mention?
Sounds as if you have an idea of what it might be. Do you want to say?
There is an argument that says it's all back to the economics.
Okay.
And if only that had been got right, all the other stuff wouldn't mean so much. But I don't know.
Well, like the question, I personally would like to see another referendum, and I hold the view it's in the government's interest to have it, because otherwise they will appear to own Brexit, which will be damaging for them. But on the question about the government's legitimacy, I don't agree. I think the government's a very representative government because it represents the divisions in the Conservative Party and the country, And I think a lot of the problems, administrative problems, that Joe drew attention to are the political problems of a Prime Minister who cannot afford to lead heroically but has to find formulae which bring the ministers inch by inch forward to an agreement in the end and to the logic of Brexit which ministers and others have been resisting up to now. So I think the government has a legitimacy, and I think it's the only way to run things. And I think the similarity is greatest, I think, between Theresa May and Harold Wilson, who also attacked for not getting a lead. He's actually the only Prime Minister who triumphed over Europe. And he said the day after the 1975 referendum, people say I have no sense of strategy. But he's the only Prime Minister who triumphed over Europe, destroyed everyone else. And there's just a chance that Theresa May too will triumph.
Can I just ask the audience, how Van said he's in favour of a second referendum, a people's vote. How many of you are in favour of a people's vote?
Almost everyone, I should say.
Gosh, yes, quite a lot, quite a lot. Okay, well, we'll come back to that in a minute. But Tony, what about the question of identity?
I think, there's no doubt that even if the referendum hadn't occurred, whatever you think about the referendum, it told us something we needed to know about how people felt. That's why I'm so strongly of the mind that whatever happens with leaving or not leaving the EU and how it's done, these other issues and more need to be dealt with. And people need to feel that the country works for them. So just part of that. I think we can all agree on that, I hope. In that sense, many years of economic change, which worked brilliantly for some people, many of us, I suspect, worked not so well for very many other people and places. And although governments, it's easy just to attack successive governments, all governments made effort at retraining people, at regional policy, and all of this stuff. And we know, and we have colleagues here at the LSE who study nothing else, the one thing in the end that my colleague Henry Overman and others would say is that the one thing that differentiates people or allows them to be competitive is their level of skill. And that's the one thing that public policy simply hasn't allowed to, for whatever reason, it hasn't worked. So, not for everybody, but in some parts of the country and for some people. So, and I think that in turn then it entirely comprehensively explains why then if you feel this and then a large number of migrants turn up in your area and it's new, you'd feel that was a threat too. I can see how that happens. I can absolutely get that. So if we just, standing back from that, if the economy grew by 3% a year and everybody benefited broadly equally from 3% a year growth forever or for 20 years, I suspect a lot of these difficulties would go away. So it is to do with, I'm not saying economic growth is everything, but it is something. And it pays for the NHS and all the other things people want to have money spent on. So I do think that spreading economic growth more equitably and ensuring that all parts of the country that some of them don't feel caught up in a spiral of decline. And none of this is helped by the decline of the high street, which has nothing to do with any of this, which has now come along as another signal of how things are changing and not for the good. So I think that economic change has a lot to explain it, but it's also the handling of it by public policy. And we just need all of us to think long and hard about what would be better done.
Which they don't seem to be doing.
Well, that's what I say, it's sucked out, all the life sucked out of the machinery for thinking.
Yeah, Joe,
I just want to come in, and it links to one of the points that Tony made about how Brexit was about other things. But what we're going to find is over the next however many years, other things will just become about Brexit. And you've already seen it in Parliament, right, last week with the Cox report about all of the bullying. And the response was, there was part of it, I think was it Margaret Beckham who came out, one of the senior Labour...
Edward Thornbury.
Came out and said, it's Brexit. But, if we get rid of Burko now, it might affect our influence on the Brexit
next
Trump's year.
Brexit bullying.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a culture war, you're absolutely right.
And
it's
if you think that the kind of, Brexit was about different things, then everything. I mean, it's very likely that lots of future battle lines in Parliament over the next 5 years will be drawn around what's the angle on Brexit, particularly if we start looking at doing anything around international trade. And then the last point I'll make is around the question of capacity in Whitehall. It's also just linked to the political capital that the Prime Minister has, and all of the kind of trade-offs that she's making to, as you said, Bernard, inch the cabinet along. She is approaching a position where actually we are a year and a half into a new government. It's just won an election. This is usually the point where any government would be doing their most ambitious things. They would be setting out their agenda for what they want to achieve over their 5 years. But everything's Brexit, right? There is no political capital available to try and deliver any other big change. I think getting the money for the NHS for its birthday present was probably one of the biggest things that's managed to happen.
Depressing, isn't it? Another question down here.
Hello, I'm Georgia from the BBC in Westminster. Just on the second referendum point, Brennan, we've obviously heard a lot from figures in Parliament about how exactly that would be done. And I think one of the most interesting arguments comes from Justine Greening and the three-way referendum. So I was wondering if you could just expand a bit more on how you think personally it should be done. And just in terms of, we've been talking about divvying up the Brexit responsibilities in Whitehall. There was an article, I think, last week about the Foreign Office and a few figures in the Foreign Office sort of bemoaning the fact that they've lost their way, they don't feel as important as they used to. And obviously you've got the Department for International Trade now, you've got DexEU who are supposed to be handling the bulk of the Brexit workload. So was there ever an alternative in terms of who should be handling the majority of the Brexit stuff? And if so, who should it have been? Should it all have fallen into the Foreign Office in the first place? Could this have been avoided in terms of divvying out all this stuff and creating potentially all these sort of inefficiencies in Whitehall, perhaps?
Well, I'll ask Georgia. I think the Foreign Office would have caught, if they'd been put totally in charge, I think Brexiteers would have had hysterics because they think the Foreign Office is on the other side. But, yeah. Joe, you know more about this than me.
Yeah, so to answer your second question first, one of the first papers the Institute for Government put out after the referendum had one big recommendation, and this was before Theresa May was made Prime Minister, which was do not set up a Brexit department, which is one of our shortest lived recommendations because it was overruled pretty quickly. And what we said was that big negotiations, big Europe negotiations, are always run by the Prime Minister. And if you set up a separate department, which has a separate Secretary of State, unless they are basically Siamese twins with the same view, you are causing problems. Because you have your officials, your negotiating team, reporting to two masters. And about a year later, we were, I don't need to be smug about it, but we proved quite right, when the negotiations were moved into the Cabinet Office and the Prime Minister said, no, the negotiations are being run here. And there has been some of those spats with David Davis saying, what's running over here, etc. It doesn't make sense. So our view is that the Cabinet Office, as the department that is seen as a natural broker without its own interests, is the best place to run this kind of thing from. Because anywhere else, you get accusations of departments having their own game in the negotiations. On the question about the FCO, I think it's a really interesting question, and you can see some of the challenges that if the FCO has been sidelined something, how that, to a certain extent, how that's been reflected. So, two interesting examples. So, one was the Irish border, and a lot of the kind of high tensions around the Irish border, I mean, it's obviously an extremely sensitive topic, but the EU published a proposal in February, where it was accused of annexation, and the Prime Minister said no living Prime Minister could ever accept this. And that proposal came out, and my understanding is much to the surprise of a lot of officials, and it came out 2 hours before Prime Minister's questions. And what the kind of, hear from diplomats, is their job would have been to say, you cannot put that language in there about staying in part of the EU's customs territory, because that is red rag to a bull. You cannot put it out 2 hours before Prime Minister's questions, because then a backbencher is then immediately going to tell her, ask her to kind of confirm that she would never accept it. And so some of that stage management stuff that potentially was what you'd look to for the Foreign Office seemed to be missing. And then the other example is obviously Salzburg in the recent summit, where it all didn't seem to go to plan, and whether that was a question of handling of diplomats and ensuring everyone was lined up on the right side, and would that have been better if the FCO had been used more? I think these are some of the interesting questions, but I do think it would have been very difficult for the FCO to manage the Brexit negotiations. And the negotiations, as I said, would be best served in Cabinet Office's coordination. All of the implementation tasks, all of the legislation tasks, that is always going to have to happen right across Whitehall. If you're putting new agricultural legislation through, it needs to be DEFRA. If you are preparing for a new agricultural policy after Brexit, it needs to be DEFRA. So the role that DEXU plays now, the part of Brexit in the EU, now that negotiations have shifted, is kind of playing that corralling game that I was talking about and making sure that departments are moving in the right direction, which we think is probably the right way. The kind of sensible setup, actually having a minister in charge for readiness, which you've got with Dominic Raab, kind of works quite well because you've got a single point at cabinet that you can shout out if things aren't going to plan.
You asked about a second referendum. Now the obvious question to ask is, do you accept the deal or would you prefer to remain? But the Brexiteers might well say, no, we want to leave, but we think the deal's a wrong one. We want a much looser relationship with Europe, a Canada-style relationship, shortly. And as you say, Justin Greening's proposed a transferable vote. I myself would rather prefer a two-stage referendum of the sort that's been held in New Zealand, the first stage being to remain or stay. And if the remain or leave, and if
the
a Freudian thing. if the vote is to leave, you then have a second referendum on leaving on the government's terms or the Brexiteers' terms. So you have a two-phase referendum. My worry about it is this: that the purpose of the referendum is to resolve a question. Now, if the vote was 52 to 48 in favour of staying, the leavers would feel cheated. There would be a xenophobic reaction from people. And therefore, it would only be settled if it was a very large majority, say 60 to 40. And the opinion polls, as Tony said, there's been a slight shift to staying, but a lot of churning behind that. Some leavers are now remainers, some remainers are now leavers. There's been a slight shift, not probably statistically very significant. And I think politicians wouldn't move until the opinion polls show 60% or more for staying, which is why I think, sadly, from my point of view, I think we probably will leave. But there would be a xenophobic...
But still, you're saying you think they'd still vote to leave?
No, I'm not sure, but I think... No, what I meant was there won't be a second referendum in my view. I think we probably will leave, because I think the opinion poll won't show 60% to stay. And I think there's a strong feeling in the public let's get it over with, let's just leave. Why is the government taking so long? You vote to leave, let's just leave and have done with it. But that may be completely wrong, it's just an instinct.
Peter Kellner, the pollster, said, I don't know if this will cheer you up or not, but overwhelmingly older people voted to leave and younger people voted to stay. And Peter Kellner says that the older ones are dying at the rate of, it's 1,300 a week. And
yes,
younger
the older
people
ones,
are coming
see,
on
you see, that's the famous Butler and Stokes provision in 1969. He said there'd be a long-term trend of labour. Mm. Because the older people tend to be more conservative than the younger people, and the older people died, but the younger people didn't, so Labour would win elections. And since then, Labour won just one election over the next 20-odd years. And you know, the trouble is the young get
younger
old.
Younger people get old,
the
yes.
The old die, the young get old.
Yes,
there's
a question down here, sorry.
Hi there, Sam Anderson. I was just wondering, it's kind of an issue of timing, and kind of legislative as well. One of the things about the continuing failure to agree on the withdrawal agreement is that the 29th of March is getting closer and closer. So I was just wondering what you thought about whether an extension of the Article 50 deadline was possible or probable, and for Joe, whether Whitehall would want it, maybe.
Joe, I don't thought Whitehall would have had hysterics practically, but you would know better.
Well, I think politically it's going to be very difficult to get an extension. I think that if you come back to the point around where we are in the negotiations, it's perfectly feasible that a negotiation at UK-EU level will be agreed in the next month, before Christmas, is I think the current plan they're working to. And there are all sorts, supposedly they're now entering what is called the tunnel, where you basically go into negotiations and it's pretty much non-stop. I think the last round was almost 15, 16 days where they were working till kind of 4 in the morning, getting out, sending shirts to the hotel so they could get, they didn't have to do washing and then go straight back in after. So it's really ramping up now. So it's perfectly feasible that a deal gets done. So time for negotiations is not that tight. Then in terms of legislative, trying to get it through Parliament, the main thing is getting the withdrawal agreement bill through. So the piece of legislation that will give legislative effect to what is agreed. And, you know, Vern will be able to tell you, actually, the UK could pass legislation pretty quickly if it wants to. The big challenge, I mean, I think the only thing is there is a 21st of January point in the Withdrawal Act, the piece of legislation that's already been passed. It says government will have to make a statement to the House if there is no agreement by the 21st of January. But that could say we are days away, we are weeks away, the House of Commons take note, and it's not going to be an amendable motion, so that doesn't really make a difference, I don't think. I mean, whether we're actually in a no-deal scenario, then the House may find different ways of making its voice heard. But, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say in a very long, waffly way is that there is no reason why, currently where we're standing, there's a desperate case for an extension. If there were an argument for extension, if it were weeks to get a deal over the line and through ratification, it's quite likely the EU would accept it. If it was okay, we're not so sure about this now, there are some things we want to revisit, the EU will say, no, you can't have an extension, you will get this through, and we'll take it from there, basically.
Well, the logic can't change with an extension. You have to decide, and we're getting to the point where it's being decided, you either say, we want to break entirely free of the European Union and follow our own independent trade policy, in which you will not get frictionless trade with the European Union, because the European Union is not a charity and will not undercut a country which is trying to undercut the European Union through competitive practices which go against the European Union. Or you say, we will align ourselves in some way together with the European Union, which means you will not get an independent trade policy. And that is the logic towards which the government is moving. It's difficult to get people to accept that logic, and you may say, and I suspect the lady who asked the first question would say, but look, if you're aligned with the European Union, what actually is the advantage of leaving it? It has no logical sense, but you know, that's what the people decided, or that's the government's interpretation of what the people decided. This logic won't change during any period of extension, and the only change, I suppose, is the precise detail of the degree of alignment that you have with the European Union. But the European Union, if you're aligned with it, will not give you the right to have an independent trade policy. You may say it doesn't matter, because countries aren't queuing up to sign agreements with us anyway, and that would take a long time, and we don't sell half as much to Australia or a fraction as much to Australia as we do to the countries on the continent. But, you know, you've got these points, but ministers take a little longer to get to that point. But the logic won't change, however long you do. But you may need longer to persuade people of the logic.
But, I mean, well, just on this question of the trade policy, I mean, I think that there is a fascinating challenge for them. Well, there's lots of a million fascinating challenges, but one of the many is that in order to get the freedom to strike the trade deals, which, you know, the global trade deals and all of that, you need a quick break, really.
Yeah, of course.
And to get the quick break, you'd have to accept temporary dislocation in parts of the economy, almost certainly. And that's a big gamble for politicians, I think, because some people say it'd be very minimal, others say it'd be very big. But the question is, the risk that it might be big must be quite an inhibitor for many MPs just in case it was a serious dislocation. And it affected, I always thought that the Brexit proposals were really about protecting manufacturing and agriculture predominantly, because those are sectors that would immediately be affected if you had to drop tariffs, for example, in order to allow food and other things to get. So I think there's a fascinating sort of challenge to politicians about how much disruption you're willing to accept in the short term to get what they would imagine were longer term
gains. More than limited, Tony. I mean, you'd have to do exactly what you said earlier, which is to lower taxation, to encourage entrepreneurs to come in, lower corporation tax, personal taxes. That means a smaller state. Mm. You deregulate, policies of deregulation, unilateral reduction of tariffs, which means a lot of manufacturing industry goes to the wall. And dare a Conservative government do this, removal of agricultural subsidies to get cheap food. It would be highly disruptive. It was in New Zealand, which followed similar policy. And that's not what people voted for. They voted for more protection, not less. That carries out the logic of Brexit. But, you know, you need to be a very brave politician, as Sir Humphrey would say, to put that in the public. I mean, it would mean a huge cut in public expenditure, for a start.
But to a certain extent, the purpose of the government's Chequers proposal was a recognition that we are going to stay aligned to the European regulatory model, because actually you kind of have two choices when you have the UK, you have the EU, or you have the US.
Yes.
And most countries, whether they've got deals with them or not, they're close enough and rely on them enough as a market that they unilaterally accept their regulations because most of their businesses do it anyway because that's how they trade. And we know what the US wants, right? They handily publish a list every year, the USTR, says, in all of these countries around the world, these are the regulations that we don't like. And in the UK, it's agricultural standards, so they'd want us to cut that. And they'd want access on healthcare to be able to use their providers to provide services in the UK. So I think the idea that one of the things we've done in being part of the EU is always dodged some of the trade-offs that you need to make. We kind of sat behind French farmers saying, oh, we're free trading buccaneers, but the French farmers are so protectionist, we could never get this through. But the reality is, if we want to try and start making trade deals after Brexit, we're going to have to address some of those trade-offs. And I think you might find, particularly a Conservative government, might find it difficult to make some of those decisions that will have a big effect on rural land.
It would be a fourth term of Margaret Thatcher. It'd be Margaret Thatcher's revenge from beyond the grave. It was why she was against the European Union in retirement, because it stopped the radical free trade, free market measures that have been applied in New Zealand and Singapore and South Korea and so on, that in the long run have brought them prosperity, but at huge disruption.
And of course, the ghost of the CAP lives on until 2022, come what may. That kind of gives us a clue, doesn't it?
It's another question here, and then I'll come to you. Russia.
Thank you. John Young. Wondering whether or not Parliament will actually approve a deal. Let's spare ourselves the details of the Irish board order. Will Parliament approve a deal? If it by chance it doesn't, then I suspect the argument, whether we're for or against for the second referendum, will grow. The only way of spiking it, I suspect, if Parliament actually approves a deal. Will they?
Well, I think if Parliament doesn't approve the deal, the Prime Minister can't continue. I had a piece in Telegraph yesterday about this. Her authority would be gone. There'll be a Conservative leadership election. I think it's unlikely the new Conservative leader would favour a referendum. The new Conservative leader would put different proposals forward, and there would in the end, I think, be no alternative to roughly the sort of deal that Parliament had rejected, but it would mean the end of Theresa May if the deal was rejected. My own hunch, and it's only a guess, it can't be more than that, the deal will be accepted, because it was seen the alternative is either no deal or some chaos within the Conservative Party that would be so close to the final date. As Tony said, the bill will not be amendable, at least the government won't accept any amendments. And so I think it's unlikely that the deal will be rejected. But if it is, the Prime Minister would have to go.
But would it make very much difference, as nobody else, as you said, with a whole different
You can't go
exciting
back and say, will you give us a better deal to Brussels?
Yeah. Well, this is
so where would there be, Jeff?
This is what is the vote on? So the vote is on the withdrawal agreement and a political declaration. Mm. So in the withdrawal agreement, you have broadly the financial settlement, where even if we're basically paying slightly more than what we've been made to pay if we went through an international court and the EU took us to court over it. So we're paying slightly more than that. On citizens' rights, I don't think anyone's seriously arguing, or at least I haven't seen anyone argue, that we've been too generous on citizens' rights and actually they want to renegotiate that. On the transition, I think Labour called for it. The Conservatives, the majority of them, recognise we need it. And then you have, quite handily, if you don't want to talk about the Irish border, that's fine, because I'm not sure if I'll come up with a solution to that now. We have the Irish border, right, where broadly Parliament is aligned that they don't like the EU's current proposal and they don't want to see a border in the Irish Sea. So on the kind of content of the withdrawal agreement, actually Parliament, there is probably a majority in there for it, just on content, if you laid it out to them and said, do you want to change this? So what is the political declaration going to be? Probably the most contentious part, but it's quite likely it will just look like a scoping note that says, these are the headings of a deal that we hope to do, and these are the things that we're going to look to try and address within it. So it won't be saying, here's Chequers, or here's Canada plus plus plus, or Super Canada, or whatever you want to call it. It will just have a kind of quite inane scoping in it. So on the topic of the deal, the content of it, it's likely that you could probably get a majority if you just went and said, blind, would you accept this deal? But the politics of it all in Parliament and the ulterior motives and Labour wanting to maybe force an election, Brexiteers having their eye on possibly leaving without a deal, some of them. So all of this stuff plays in, which is totally impossible to predict.
Lots of fudge.
Yeah.
It's fudge, yes. Another question, Dan. I can use give him the microphone.
Thank you. My name's Conor Daly. Joe provided some excellent examples of changes in political communication throughout the referendum campaign and while Brexit is implemented. I wanted to ask the panel to what extent they felt the changes were a sort of natural response to the sovereignty of the people being established, and whether they think the changes are permanent.
Tony, would you like to?
Well, if we go first, Ben.
Do you mean change in political communication because of the comments made that think were
I think the sort of nature of the dialogue in the political landscape at the minute, and people potentially feel that either the quality of the debate or levels of sort of personal aggression and distaste have increased.
Yes, I mean, I think people assume there was once a golden age when elections and referendums, for that matter, were rather like university seminars, but actually they weren't. And a lot of things said in elections are not strictly true. I mean, in 1945, Churchill said that the Labour government would introduce a Gestapo if elected. In 1931, the Conservatives, or National Government, said that the Labour government would threaten your post office savings. In 1992, Neil Kinnock said a Conservative government would abolish the National Health Service, and so on. And it's fair to say, I mean, I was a Remainer, but it's fair to say there were exaggerations, shall we say, on both sides of the debate, because George Osborne said it would be an immediate recession if we voted to leave. And one of the reasons I think that the Remainers have become a bit discredited is the economy doesn't seem to have moved so disastrously as some predicted. So I honestly think this is a rough and tumble, and I don't think people voted under a misapprehension. I don't agree with the vote, but I think people voted on the basic grounds of, firstly, they wanted EU immigration controlled, and secondly, they wanted Britain, they wanted to take back control in the sense they wanted Parliament to be supreme again, even if perhaps that made them a bit poorer. I think those were the two basic reasons why people voted they did, and given that's what people thought, they were right to do so. I don't agree with them, and I don't agree with a lot of results of elections either, neither here nor there. So I think some of the people who complain about this, not themselves, some of you complain, just complain they don't like the result. But I think you could say that about any appeal to the people. I think there's a famous occasion when the American presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson spoke to a university audience to great enthusiasm, and someone said, well, all right-minded people will vote for you. And he said, that's not enough, I need a majority.
Well, I sort of almost agree with Vernon on this. I mean, I do think that there's no doubt that, I mean, creativity with statistics and creativity with forecasts was pretty, at scale during the Brexit referendum. But it's not unique to the Brexit referendum. I'm almost every morning, you know, I wake up to something on the radio where, you know, there's a criticism about cuts to public spending and whatever it is, and then a minister pops up and says, oh, well, we're spending 230 million more on it. And I think, well, yeah, but, you know, I mean, what does that tell us? I mean, you know, and so every day, all the time, and it's not just this government, all governments do it, you know, Labour used to add up all the spending for years to come and say we're spending X hundred billion pounds on this over 5 years. Yeah. So, but what I do think is that there's a bit of a risk that in the fallout, and Vernon did touch on this, from the, you know, not all the forecasts, you know, the economy didn't fall over a cliff. And it didn't fall over a cliff. And in that sense, the sense that it might, the sort of project fear, did produce an easy win for a sort of syllogistic, false syllogism, which is, these forecasts were wrong, therefore all forecasts are wrong. And the truth is, not all forecasts will be wrong. Go on, Vernon.
Well, I want to make a point about this.
My honourable friend, as they say.
I do want to make a point about this, and I think all of us, and I include myself in this criticism, we've all given too much confidence to things we've said, and I think this is partly the media partly to blame for this. I mean, you know, when a physicist speaks about the law of gravity or a chemist about the effects of one chemical on another, they can be pretty certain. We can't be as certain as that. And many people, and I find people myself, we've spoken with overconfidence. And that is the merit of what Goad said about experts. The social sciences don't have that sort of credibility, and they can't have it. And economists and other social sciences, political science, have been spoken with much too much confidence. And We all got our comeuppance, and we all got our comeuppance in the election. If you look at how many laws of political science were refuted in the election, you can't gain votes from the extremes, the young never vote, a host of other things that in the election that the result confuted, the two-party system being undermined, and so on and so on. And we treated these laws as if they're cast iron in the way that laws of physics and chemistry are. You know, it's right that people are now more sceptical of what we say, frankly. Sorry, it's not the message for the LSE, I realise, but I mean...
we still prize expertise. But just... something Joe said and I muttered, and just finished this point. that, well, notwithstanding, I take the mea culpa, the plural mea culpa, for expertise... But one thing I do think all of this has led to, which I think, and Joe referred to it indirectly earlier, and is, I think now, for some, not only inescapable, but might affect the entire operation of the major political parties from now on, which is the evolution of a culture war off the back of the referendum, and the way the culture war will now affect the political parties. Brexit, and Joe's absolutely right, almost everything is now viewed through the warped prism of, you know, somebody says something, well, were they for and against Brexit? And once that happens, then left and right is less important than that. And you can begin to see the major political parties, the Labour and Conservative parties, are beginning to morph into something which is more than their traditional tribal left-right versions of themselves, and could actually lead to a split in politics which is no longer really left-right, but is on the basis of something completely different, because it's a culture war.
What would it encompass? Would it encompass, for example, a particular economic policy? Would Brexiteers be in favour of turning Britain into a sort of Singapore?
Well, I think it would... That's a very good question, because, again, going back to something Vernon said, there's a further challenge to all of this, which is that I think some of the most pro-Brexit politicians who are in the Conservative Party do have a vision for the impact Brexit could have on Britain, which is radically to alter its economic functioning. I think you're absolutely right about that. But what thing I'm sort of talking about, which is different, or I mean makes that more difficult, is that you could see from the Canterbury and Mansfield results at the general election in 2017 that the Conservative Party could become more a party of people who voted for Brexit, people who feel that the economy hasn't worked for them, the North. And the Labour Party has become more a party of London, which it now wins epically in, even though it's the richest part of the United Kingdom, and, you know, a more open approach to the world. So there are people on the left who are very protectionist, by the way. So all I'm saying is that these changes arguably have started. The question is, how far do they go into the traditional British political parties, particularly Labour and the Conservatives.
Yeah, just what's your view? And would it affect Whitehall if we did have this a new sort of realignment?
Well, it was coming back to the question about the change in sort of discourse. Mm-hmm. And one of the effects is, I mean, it seems to me that the civil service has become increasingly politicised, right? I have the number of kind of biographies of Ollie Robbins that gets published in kind of like the FT or the Times. And I can't think of a civil servant who's had that much kind of focus and scrutiny and treated as, I mean, there's more written about him than members of the cabinet, basically. Mm. And we were at Conservative Party conference, we were running events there. We went to a kind of quite Eurosceptic fringe group, and every time his name was mentioned, 250 people booed in unison. There was lots of boos for other people as well, but he got quite loud boos. And this is a challenge, right? There's lots of focus on, is it the civil service that is the establishment that's driving Brexit away from what was voted for? And the best example of this was, there was a select committee hearing at the Exiting the EU committee, and Ollie Robbins was giving evidence, Jacob Rees-Mogg was asking him questions. He was saying, there's, you know, these rumours that Number 10 and the Cabinet Office were working on a different white paper to the one that DexEU were working on, the department. You know, this is a constitutional outrage that officials in the centre are changing what comes from departments. And Hilary Benn interrupted, who had been a minister when he was in the Labour government, and said, to anyone who's been in a Cabinet government, that sounds pretty normal to me, in that actually, it's always been the case that Number 10 changes what comes from departments. They'll send up policy briefings. Number 10 will be like, well, we'll tweak this, we'll change this, and send it back saying, here's your briefing, we've approved it, and it looks very different. And so I think that the case is that a lot of this criticism of Ollie Robbins is actually, a lot of it is you're talking about Number 10, the Cabinet, and the Prime Minister, who's given the direction. Ollie Robbins is just delivering what guidance, delivering guidance and then taking on policy decisions. But it will be interesting to see if that stays, the kind of civil service as a political actor beyond Brexit.
The great danger, this will continue after Brexit, yeah. When it doesn't bring the benefits that people imagine, Jacob Rees-Mogg and the others will say it's because there were traitors in high places, mm-hmm. in the Conservative Party, civil service, no doubt elsewhere. And if only it had been negotiated by pure-hearted people, then the benefits would be there, which is the argument on the Nixon in China principle for having Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg and the rest actually negotiating the outcome. But then you couldn't then say that. But if it's not negotiated by them, the argument would be there's been betrayal in high places, and that's why we haven't got the benefits that we should have had from Brexit. And that, therefore, I think, far from being the constitutional moment that I hope, Brexit could be a populist moment, the stab in the back legend.
Isn't it the case, though, that in the past, when Thatcher came in, when Blair came in, and there was provision for him to appoint his own chief of staff, I mean, this happens periodically. One permanent secretary once said to me, you know, standard manoeuvre number one by politicians, when in doubt, blame the civil service.
Yeah, yeah.
Haven't we been here before?
Yeah, I think that's true. It's, I guess, notable in the kind of scale of celebrity around Ollie Robbins, I guess, as one individual, rather than the civil service as a kind of dark unit that no one can necessarily see inside. Not dark as in opaque, rather than anything to do about their interests.
What do you think is going to happen? I mean, presumably you would say that there isn't any truth in the idea that they're partisan, they're doing whatever their ministers tell them.
No, I think, yeah, exactly. They are taking orders from the Prime Minister. I think there is a challenge for civil servants when decisions aren't taken, but there is a ticking clock. Mm-hmm. What do you do? How do you approach that? I think there have been some challenges where, in response to the kind of problems with the forecasting, the perception that the civil service will project fear, it's made it possibly harder for the civil service to put out some of the more robust messages that you would perhaps expect of them around the deliverability and the negotiability of some of the things that have come through. John Thompson, the chief executive of HMRC, is very good at select committees. He doesn't pull his punches, unlike others where you can see them kind of slowly walking their way around a question and into safe ground. He just tackles it head on and says, this is how much it's going to cost. No, there's no way we're going to be able to deliver it by then. And he got death threats for the pleasure of telling a parliamentary select committee how long it will take to change a customs system, which is now apparently the thing that gets a civil servant death threats.
And I think the other, I mean, yeah, again, this, I'm sure this isn't unique, but given the highly visible nature of it, it's been clear from reading, you know, the endless amounts that are written about it in the newspapers, some of it by you, of course, Sue, that the truth is the British the civil service has, for a long time, been negotiating without a detailed remit, because the government, if it never could never produce a detailed remit, because that would immediately have broken up the coalition. So it held the coalition together by never having a very detailed remit. So the civil servants have been having to negotiate details without a detailed remit. And I can see that that led them to shape up things a bit more than they otherwise would have wished to, perhaps, as civil servants, precisely in order to get something back to London, to get them to react to it. I picked this idea up, as I say, from reading in the press. But, you know, so I can see the problem the civil service has had. It's been negotiating. It does all the hard work all day in, day out, without a detailed remit. And that makes it easier to accuse them of having, as it were, acted beyond their role.
Well, that's true. It's a bit like Sir Humphrey Appleby. I think, actually, it might have been Bernard, his sidekick, who was once asked, well, what does the civil service do when the chips are down? To which he replied, the job of the civil service is to see that the chips stay up. Well, we are at 8 o'clock. I'm afraid we've got to finish. Thank you very much to our panellists. I think it's been fascinating. And thank you all very much indeed for coming.
Thank you.